This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Welcome, everybody. Back in 1862, in his message to Congress, President Lincoln called our country the last best hope of earth. And one wonders, given the rancor and division that America is experiencing now, whether or not we all really believe that. Do we still see America as exceptional? Do we believe we can keep our republic, even as the left wages war on both our history and our future? Well, we live in some very uncertain days, but the history of our great nation shows we have never been a country that has been immune to difficulty, and that's why it's important to know our history and shore up the hope we all have that America will continue to be the greatest nation on earth. So we're going to tackle this subject today with Dr. Bill Bennett, former Secretary of Education under President Reagan and one of America's most influential and respected voices on cultural, political, and educational issues. He is host of the Bill Bennett Show podcast, also the Washington Fellow of the American Strategy Group, and the author and editor of more than 25 books, and is just out with a revised and condensed version of the three-volume series he released a decade ago now, America, the Last Best Hope. And it is so great to talk to you again, Dr. Bennett. How are you?
Hello, Janet. That's great to talk to you. And that was a beautiful introduction. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I was inspired. When I read your books, I always talk a little bit better. And when I listen to you, I talk a little bit better. But it really is great to talk to you. And I suppose the problem with writing a definitive book on American history is that history marches on and a lot has happened in the last decade, hasn't it?
Yeah. And I try to treat that respectfully, though briefly, because we need time to digest history. I have opinions about things in the last 10 years, but I've spared the reader most of them till all the returns are in. So, I'm much more comfortable talking about, concluding with the Reagan era or the Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. But I do mention the Obama administration, George W. Bush, and the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You say the first and foremost reason you wrote the book in the first place was to offer hope. And I think that hope in many regards is in short supply right now. Do you have that same sense that right now is a really good time to go back and remind Americans of their history?
I do. And the reason I have hope is because I think I know enough about America to believe, Janet, that, we have a way of self-correcting. The antibodies kick in. The capacity for self-renewal in America is very, very strong and very, very deep. It's a tough time. I also think that we are a blessed country. I think we are uniquely blessed. In the long story of inhumanity and misery that's human history, the American achievement is unique. But the irony is, and the real reason for writing the book, is because it is the greatest political story ever told, and our people don't know that story. Yeah. Certainly our young people, but indeed many of our older people as well.
Well, you're right about that. I have seen more and more people say in recent days, boy, we really do need to go back and especially re-examine the American Revolution, not only because that was so critical to our own history as Americans, but also because of its uniqueness in the scope of human history. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, because I think that's a fascinating topic to re-examine.
Yeah, well, it is. It is unique in human history. It is the most generous of all nations. It is the only nation to be founded on deliberation and reflection, and whose political system was designed not by, the invasion, not by toppling, one government, but by thoughtful consideration of alternatives. We had a revolution. We broke from England. But then the design of this new republic was deliberate. It was thoughtful. It wasn't by chance. It was by consideration. And here's the interesting thing. The design that was put in place has worked. And although we're a young country, as far as the world goes, Janet, we have lived longer under a single set of documents and principles than any nation in the world.
Yeah.
And that's truly remarkable. And the second remarkable thing is, even though we're a very young country, our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, are the most imitated political documents in the world. And third, to go to the headlines of today, we are still the country, despite all the problems that we have, and Lord knows if one watches Democrat debates, you'd think we were really in an immiserated state. It is still the country where most of the world would, if it had a chance, like to get to.
Oh, absolutely. That's the irony, isn't it? Especially when we're talking about the border debate. If it's so horrible in the United States, why in the world are so many people flocking to come here and get here at any price?
You're absolutely right. Why? Haven't they heard Bernie Sanders talk about what a horrible place this is? And,
right.
And Elizabeth Warren? Why do these people keep coming? You know, when I was Secretary of Education, my wife, and you've met Elaine, told me to go around and teach classes, go to the schools. I went to 120 schools, and I remember a young woman said to me, why do you love America? And I said, well, I'll write it down someday, and that's this book, America, the Last Best Hope. Mm-hmm. I said, but, you know, the shorthand is every country has gates. And, you know, one test of a country is when you raise the gates, which way do people run? Do they run in or do they run out?
Yeah. Right.
And I said, we raise our gates, people run in. We don't raise our gates and people try to get in. So that tells you something. Indeed, it's the foot test. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, you know, it's interesting when you use that quote from President Lincoln's message to Congress. He
right.
was arguing at the time that emancipation was the straightest path to mm-hmm. victory, because if you give freedom to slaves, then Americans would be assuring freedom to the free. And it really strikes me as being so relevant for right now, not slavery per se, but the issue of freedom. We are seeing freedom of speech under attack. We're seeing big tech censorship. We're seeing freedom of religion under attack. What about this principle of freedom and the likelihood of being able to preserve that when the worldview on the left seems to be so off kilter in even wanting to preserve freedom?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a complicated question. Freedom is at the heart of it. Freedom and equality. Those are the two founding principles that I think are so fundamental. And freedom's under assault all around the world. And you know, again, just to bring it to the headlines, what is going on here with big business and basketball with China?
Yes.
Whatever happened to the dedication to freedom?
Right.
I mean, you know, I've been around a long time, and this stuff makes me kind of slack-jawed. What? You know, what are people saying? You know, for the almighty dollar, we will genuflect and forget the things that we hold dear. We have to remind ourselves of these things. Right. Lincoln says in 1862, we shall nobly save or meanly lose this last best hope of earth. And of course, the struggle that was going on at the time for freedom and equality was a struggle the world was watching. And Lincoln believed, and I believe he was right, that the world would ponder the result. And if we lost that struggle, you know, the world might have ended in a greater amount of slavery than in freedom. Of course, the best testimony I can remember, and it's in my book and a footnote in this version, when Ronald Reagan's old story about the guy in the China Sea, the naval vessel in the China Sea, and they see a little wooden craft, a little, you know, a very hastily constructed craft out there with a man in it. And so they let a boat over the side to go see what's going on. It's a naval officer in the small boat approaching. And as he gets closer, here's this refugee from Asia, from Vietnam, and he's shouting at him. And as he gets closer, the naval officer can make out what the man is shouting. He doesn't speak English, but he knows a couple of words. And he says, hey, freedom man, come get me, freedom man. That's what America means, has meant to the world. And I hope the NBA can figure that out.
Yeah, to see them throwing people out of the game simply for holding up signs backing the Hong Kong protests is almost unbelievable to me.
Yeah. How about that? So I have a friend. We'll wait and see if this makes the news. But for the Lakers game that's coming up, he's making T-shirts. Apparently, if it's an article of clothing, they can't remove you. If it's a sign, they can. We'll see.
Well, I think that it's so important to stand up for freedom, because this is what America is all about. And without freedom, would we really be America? That, I mean, this is what is really going through a lot of people's minds, Dr. Bennett. And that's why I think it's so important for people to really reexamine American history. We're going to take a very short break. We're talking with Dr. Bill Bennett, former Secretary of Education, author of America, The Last Best Hope. We'll return right after this. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and I want to tell you about a 10-year-old Syrian girl named Hanifa. Hanifa lost her mother when she was just 18 months old, and now she lives in a refugee camp in Lebanon. She's smart, she's vivacious, and she's seen more suffering than a child her age should ever see, all because she's a victim of what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. But because Heart for Lebanon is on the ground in her camp, Hanifa recently placed her faith and trust in Jesus for salvation, and now because her father is illiterate, she's reading the Bible to him every evening. The Lord is using Heart for Lebanon in a powerful way. They're bringing food, survival essentials, and Christian education to girls like Hanifa and their families. And these families are coming to know the Lord. But Heart for Lebanon needs your help to keep helping the desperate. Right now, you can help rescue a family of six in Lebanon with food, Christian education, and survival essentials for just 98 cents a day. That's just $29 a month. All you have to do to help is to call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. The war in Syria is not over. And even if the war stopped today, the UN estimates it will take 50 years to rebuild the country. Jesus said the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. The Lord has sent the workers of Heart for Lebanon into his harvest field, but they need the help of other Christians to keep on doing what they're doing. We need your help. $29 a month will help rescue a family of six. All you have to do is call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. These families need your immediate help. Please pick up the phone and call, 888-247-5499. 888-247-5499. Thank you, and God bless. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thanks for joining us. And it is great to be joined by Dr. Bill Bennett, former Secretary of Education, host of the Bill Bennett Show podcast, and author of so many great books, including the one we're talking about, the newly revised and condensed version of America, The Last Best Hope. And, you know, it's interesting, Dr. Bennett, when we're talking about American history, of course, as the former Secretary of Education, this has to get to you that so few of the younger generation really understand this history as they should. These polls that are coming out where you see Generation Z and the millennials saying they would prefer to live in a socialist country. How does that strike you to hear that?
Yeah, it strikes me hard, and it's discouraging, but you're absolutely right. But, you know, you remain alien to yourself in a country in which your past is denied. Right. This is your birthright. This is part of who you are. You are born an American. You become an American. And you must reclaim that birthright. You must rediscover it. It's very interesting, isn't it, Janet, to see this big movement in these genetic testing thing where people check their nationality and where they came from. I wish people showed the same degree of interest in where they live.
Oh, yeah.
In the country in which they are thriving. The country to which those relatives from other countries came. I remember a colleague of mine who worked with me in Washington, conservative professor, used to say, tell the story of his grandfather who emigrated from Italy to come to New York. And John would say to his grandfather, are we going back to Italy? And he said, maybe someday, but if I wanted you to stay there, I would have never left.
Right.
You know, there's a reason people come here.
Yeah.
Yes, we do not know this story. And if our young people don't know this story, and by the way, said put on the Secretary of Education hat, this is our worst subject in school. The reading and math scores, I could go on and on about for hours, but our scores in American history are even worse. We do not know who we are, our own legacy, our own special achievement. So when someone comes along and says, well, this capitalist system is so corrupt, it's so awful. Well, how about socialism? A lot of young people are like sitting ducks. Yeah. And I have to say, it's not just the history books which tend in this direction, and many of the faculty. This is what you're hearing from the Democrat debates.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, once again, why would anyone come to a place like this?
Well, you have to wonder about that. If you were to sit down with some of these millennials and Generation Z students today, if you were the teacher in the classroom, there's so much to unfold clearly in American history. But to clear up this idea that socialism is a wonderful ideal that we should all strive for, where would you go in American history to debunk that?
Well, I would go to, actually, interestingly, right now, we have a test in the U.S. of the strength of the labor movement. But one of the great strengths of the labor movement, and I'll give some credit to the old Democrat Party here, is that it resisted the siren call of socialism.
Yeah.
And because we were thoughtful about how to include workers in the negotiations for wages and salary and working conditions, we avoided that alternative of revolution and socialism and communism, because we were open to that, because we thought, you know, maybe people do deserve a better deal. This was part of what America is about. Samuel Gompers, you know, we talk about Samuel Gompers in the book and other people. And because organized labor, because labor was able to organize and work with management, most of the time in a satisfactory way, sometimes not, sometimes you get these strikes, we were able to avoid that alternative. Other countries not. But the best way I would teach socialism would not be by looking at America. I would look at the countries that have tried it. Socialism is, Janet, what socialism does. And look at the record of those countries where it's been tried.
Yeah.
And the main thing you get is a body count. 20
right.
million, 40 million, 100 million. I got to say this, if I may, just a political comment. Whether President Trump gets a good deal or not out of the negotiations with China, I think Americans are going to give him credit for taking on this this Leviathan, this horribly repressive regime, and confronting it. Where are all the liberal media and professors? Not talking about the 1 million Muslim Uyghurs who have been imprisoned in these camps where they're maybe being their body parts are being harvested. Where are the critics? Where's the publicity for that? I give the president great credit for that. I think he wins even if we don't get a deal.
Yeah, I do as well. I think that's really well said.
Good.
I think that's really well said. You know, it's interesting. One of the latest developments, you had mentioned the Democratic debates and, you know, all these people are trying to out-radicalize each other. You know, I'm to the left. No, I'm further to the left. I'm even further to the left. And it's so insane.
Yeah.
And a lot of Americans will look at this with a little bit of a shrug and say, they're all insane. Don't worry. Trump's going to win in a landslide. But be that as it may, the fact that you now have one of the two major American political parties fully embracing this insanity. How do you recover from this as a nation when it's not just one, you know, Bernie Sanders, but it's an entire party now?
Well, you know, we may have a good test case here in the election. The Trump political structure is going to be able to put a microscope on what it is that's proposed. You've heard one or two hard questions in these debates. The hard questions are coming up, believe me. If it's Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or even the new, quote, new and improved, the Joe Biden who's going to the left as well.
Yeah.
We will see these things up close, and I think they will be resisted. But, you know, it's not inevitable that this republic survives in the form in which it was designed. Madison worried about this. Adams worried about it. George Washington worried about it. They would be, people say, what would the founders say if they were alive today? Most people I've heard answer that, I think, don't get it quite right. The first thing they'd say is, holy smokes. Well, not holy smokes,
yeah.
But they'd say, gosh, or whatever. They'd say, it has survived this long. In 6 years, it will be 250 years,
right.
six, 7 years since the Declaration of Independence. Many of them would be shocked that this experiment in ordered liberty survived that long. They would be very proud of their work, as they should be.
Well, that's right. I think they would be a little shocked that we've lasted this long and maybe not surprised by where we are now. But a lot of Americans are saying with this attack on American history, this is a big issue for a lot of conservatives. Yep. The left tearing down monuments, wanting to condemn people like Jefferson for having been a slaveholder, and all of these attacks, you know, getting rid of Columbus Day. Do you see the trajectory being more in the on the side of more and more and more of that and them being able to win that battle? Or do you think Americans will reach a breaking point where they say enough already? I mean, how do you see that coming down when you're looking at both sides going at it?
To be perfectly honest, I think it's up for grabs. Justice Holmes said, if something's inevitable, remember the mode in which the inevitable comes to pass is effort. And it will take efforts, educational efforts. Look, when you see that a majority of millennials prefer socialism to capitalism, makes you worry about the answer to your question. Do I believe in America? Do I believe that we will prevail? Yes, because we've had testing before, very serious tests, and we've survived it. But this is a real struggle, and this is an ideological struggle. We'll see how it turns out. But, Plato said in his dialogues, the thing I remember most of anything, and this is what I studied, philosophy, is the single most important question of society is who gets to teach the children and what do we teach them? I think you'd agree with me.
Yes.
And what I'm asking for your audience to do is to think about this book, and maybe for a young person, it can even be an older person, for your nephew, a niece, a grandchild, a child, here's the handbook, which explains what this country's about. This is the artillery you need to get engaged in this fight.
Oh, that's right. You know, many people also will raise the possibility. We went through a civil war once before in this country, and it was absolutely horrific, even if the outcome was to abolish slavery. You know, there were a lot of lives lost, tons and tons of lives lost. Do you see the possibility of ever having a civil war in this country again? It seems unthinkable to a lot of us, but there are people who talk about it and say, do you think it'll ever come to that? Look at Antifa in the streets. They're willing to get violent. Is it going to come to that? We don't know. But what likelihood do you think there might be?
I don't think so, because I think there's a huge degree of tolerance in the American people for difference of opinion. People will even live with being called racist, bigot. They hate it, but they'll live with it for the sake of free expression and their dedication to our principles. But when people go out and become violent, I think most Americans, 60, 70, 80%, draw the line there and say no. And again, I think the capacity of Americans to self-renew, to take a measured look at things, will prevail in the end. But it may take a while to get to that end, particularly in the next few years. My friend Alan Gelzo, who's a wonderful professor of history at Gettysburg College and at Princeton, taught one of my sons there, says we may be as much divided now, Janet, as we have ever been in American history, other than the Civil War. I don't know if that's right, but the division is very real and very serious. You can see it in the acrimony. You can see it in what happens at a Donald Trump rally. And it's real and has to be confronted. I don't think we go to war with each other, but would make it kind of humorous. Look at the political debate going on today, the names that are being called. This is where we are now. Where are we going to be in 10 months on the eve of this?
I know. But, mentioned Trump rallies. That actually gives me a little bit of hope, because wherever he turns out, you have thousands of people enthusiastically standing in line all night and screaming and yelling in the rallies. There's not anything the media can do about that. Meanwhile, Biden can barely fill a room and he's the front runner.
No, I know, and that certainly tells you something. One of the things that really troubles me is the retreat of the conservative intellectuals, or a lot of them, on this.
Yes,
I've thinned out my Rolodex. When I was identified on an intellectual geographical map, I was identified as a neoconservative. My embrace of Donald Trump has cost me a lot of friends, or people who I thought were friends. But it's just extraordinary, the number of people who whose names your audience knows, you would be surprised, who just cannot abide this president. I think that's a terrible thing because we need to take the fight on the intellectual level, on every level.
I'm with you. Dr. Bill Bennett, America, the last best hope. Pick it up. And so good to talk to you again. Thanks so much, Dr. Bennett.
Thank you, Janet. Well done. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
All right. God bless you. We'll be back right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Well, Christmas will be here before we know it. I know. And that means a busy season for modern hymn writers Keith and Kristen Getty. Not only are they gearing up for their latest tour, but they are also releasing a new Christmas album. It is called Sing an Irish Christmas, live at the Grand Ole Opry House. And Keith Getty joins us now to tell us more. Keith, great to welcome you back. How are you?
Great to be in the show, Janet. It is the most wonderful time of the year.
I agree. It's wonderful, but it's busy for you, isn't it? You've got an album, you've got a tour. Tell us a little bit about your album. What's it all about? Because a lot of people will have Joy in Irish Christmas. You had a live version, you had a studio version. How is the new one different?
Well, Janet, I want to publicly on national radio blame you personally for it.
Me? How is it my fault?
We had a conversation 3 years ago when our show was on PBS, and you quoted some statistic that only one of America's 40 most loved carols was religious, as an example of secularism in society.
Yeah.
And it got me so mad the rest of that day. Like, I was in a bad mood, walking around in like a complete strop. But I went away, and then I had a dark night of the soul going, why, if I'm a hymn writer, do I still do a Christmas show? And then I thought, okay, this is not about me, and it's not about Janet's statistic. What we need to do is, we need to do a combined effort to get the nation learning the great 10 carols of our faith.
Great.
And so we recorded an album that came out last month, which is called the Family Carol Sing, which is the 10 carols that everybody should know, plus a few modern ones. And then we've recorded nearly all of them again live at the Grand Ole Opry. And they'll all be available eventually on Spotify as part of this record. But the whole idea is getting the nation singing the 10 carols that explain the gospel to everybody. And you can actually take part of the blame.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I just thought that was a terrible statistic. And that's neat. I'm really glad you're doing that because there's nobody better to do that. But talk a little bit about these hymns everybody should know, these Christmas hymns, these 10 ones that you've picked.
Sure. Well, I'll give you the 10. So if you're listening, you can write them down. The 10 we've chosen are Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Charles Wesley. Mild he lays his glory by, born that man no more may die, born to raise the sons of earth, born to give his second birth. We're doing Joy to the World, which is celebrating its 300th anniversary this year, and we have a special 300th anniversary version of Joy to the World. Then the third one is Come My Long Expected Jesus, born to set thy people free, again Charles Wesley. Born a people to deliver, born a child and yet a king, born to reign in us forever. Now the grace that your kingdom bring. Number four is O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel. Number five is O Little Town of Bethlehem, how silently the wondrous gift is given. So God imparts to human hearts the blessings of his heaven. No ear may hear his coming, but in this world of sin where meek souls will receive him still, the dear Christ enters in. Number six is O Come, All Ye Faithful, O Come, Let Us Adore Him. Number seven is Silent Night. We've even got a few unknown verses which were beautiful about the gospel, which have been included. Number eight is In the Bleak Midwinter, What Can I Give Him, Poor As I Am? If I Were a Shepherd, I would Bring a Lamb. Number nine is Angels We Have Heard on High. Angels We Have Heard on High. We combine that with Joy Has Dawned. And number 10 was written in Ireland, once in Royal David City. It was written to help children understand the Christmas story. And it opens the King's College Cambridge Carol Service every year. It's a little less than over here, but we do it in our service every year. And actually, Deborah Clemmie, our violinist, her little son will be singing the first verse. And it is just an extraordinary moment. So anyway, that's the 10 carols.
Well, those are wonderful. You know, Keith, it's interesting because many people do get their theology from music, don't they? And does this tie into some of your concerns about reintroducing or re-stressing the importance of these 10 hymns that you've just listed?
No, absolutely. We live, Janet, in the most exciting generation in history to be Christian. I wouldn't want to have been born in my grandparents' generation if the things were simpler. We were at Prince Edward Island last weekend, and my wife often said she wanted to be born when Anne of Green Gables was around and wished I had Gilbert Blythe's manners and charm. But really, I would never have wanted to be born in another generation. We live in the most exciting generation in history. More chances to communicate the gospel, more chances to share the gospel. There are more Christians in the world. The Bible is in more languages. But we also live in the best of times and the worst of times, as Charles Dickens said. And so we need to build deep believers. And I don't believe that we build deep believers by teaching them shallow songs in church and teaching them shallow songs as children. You know, my first responsibility in life is making sure my children grow up singing the gospel so they remember it all their lives. And so our passion, the thing that makes us get up and really sacrifice our time, is to get children and churches singing the gospel story. And the carols are so beautiful. Yeah, you know, yeah. That's the thing about it. They're just stunningly beautiful poetry. They sing so beautifully. Every year, you get this feeling as well, I'm sure, as you sing them, and you just realize just how beautifully the phrases are put. And how much they don't just tell you about salvation, but they tell you about the humanity of the Christmas story. They combine, you know, the vulnerability, the humanity, the reality, the emotion of the story.
Yes. Well, and they're so singable. One of the things I really enjoy about singing those classic Christmas carols is the fact that I can do harmony. I mean, I just enjoy doing that. I enjoy the different parts that people can take on, for sure.
No, it's exactly right. They harmonize perfectly. And it's the greatest composers in history. Hark the Herald Angels Sing was written by Mendelssohn.
Yeah.
And the Bleak Midwinter was written by Holst. Mm. You know, and so they're just extraordinary, extraordinary, really.
That's neat. Well, now you have a tour coming up in December as well, right?
Oh, yeah. This year's I think, is my favorite ever. As you know, each year, our show is the only sort of Christian show in the Carnegie Hall Christmas season and in the Kennedy Center Christmas season.
Wow.
And this is the sixth year at Carnegie Hall, and it's fast selling out. And Kristen's uncle John Lennox is coming over to do the Christmas lessons. Our Christmas show, the first half, is like an Irish celebration of Christmas, where it's music and dance and singing together, and it's really high energy. And then the second half is like a lessons and carol service by candlelight, where we read the Christmas story and sing carols together, slightly more classical and reflective. And this year, Kristen's uncle John Lennox is doing the readings at Carnegie. And then on the 14th, don't miss this, the 14th of December, if you're thinking something for Christmas, in Washington, D.C. at the Kennedy Center, the readings are being done by Johnny Erickson Tata.
Yes.
She's receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award, but we sort of think called the Sing Lifetime Achievement Award for someone who has transformed singing for the global church. And we just feel her reality and vulnerability of how she has sung and got a generation of people singing through suffering, singing through the soul, singing in their soul. It's just such an extraordinary witness. That's an amazing thing. But she's going to be telling her story. And of course, her accident happened not far from the Kennedy Center many years ago. So it's going to be, I think, a really emotional night and a really special night, actually.
Well, that is so neat. And we had the opportunity, our family, to come see you and Kristen last year in Dallas. And it was fabulous. It was absolutely wonderful and just a fun night and lots of favorites and lots of new hymns. And it's just wonderful, I can say from experience. I really, really enjoyed it. We all did so much. And I want to mention to people, just because we had a subject just there about awards, but you just won the Dove Award for Inspirational Album of the Year. So I wanted to congratulate you guys.
Oh, thank you. It was just last week. Yeah, that was the North Coast Sessions. And that's just our band. And I mean, it's really, you know, we could have the privilege, except for our drummer, Wendell, who's new, our whole band have been together an average of 10 years or more. So we've just done life together. And even this Christmas show was so special because we did it. We've traveled together. It's the ninth year of the Christmas show. And then secondly, we did it at the Grand Ole Opry as part of the Sing Conference this year. And TBN came in and recorded. So it's going to be on TV this Christmas on TBN multiple times, which we're really excited about. And then on top of that, you know, it's just to get to travel with those guys. We had a few special guests as well, I should say. We did our first ever partnership with rap. Who would have thought Irish hymn writers and rap went? But you were there for our debut. You were there at the Windspear for our debut rap collaboration.
Yes.
And Triple E.
Yes.
Came and did O Children Come for the album, which is amazing. Then Ellie Holcomb, who many of you will know, she and my wife are both called Elizabeth, And my wife's middle name is Elizabeth. Their moms are called Elizabeth. Their grandmas are called Elizabeth. So they wrote a song called Elizabeth on the story of Elizabeth from the Christmas story.
Oh, wow.
And so they sing a gorgeous duet called Elizabeth based on the Christmas story, which is amazing. It's probably my favorite song on the project. Matt Papa and Matt Boswell's new hymn, Sing Me the Song of Emmanuel. They wrote His Mercy is More, all these modern hymns. They're on it. You remember we celebrated Silent Night's 200th anniversary last year. And at Carnegie Hall, the Night of Legends, Phil Keggy flew in and played a guitar solo on it. And he came back to the Opry, and so Phil Keggy guested with us at the Opry as well. So lots of fantastic guests. Pedro Eustache, who was in Passion of the Christ as well. It's a very high energy live at the Grand Opry, Old Opry experience.
Wow!
But you still, I think this time we've managed to get a better balance of you feel like you're at the live event, like you were at the Windspear or Carnegie. You feel the energy and the screaming of the audience when people are doing solos.
Well,
so we're really excited about Friday and the album.
Yeah, well, very exciting. GettyMusic.com. Thanks a lot, Keith Getty. Great to have you. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
When I heard her heartbeat, I decided to keep her. And now my daughter's about to be 3. I don't know where my life would be without her.
The Ministry of Preborn invites you to share your pro-life message through sharing heartbeats. You see, when a young woman considering abortion sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, 8 out of 10 times, she'll choose life for her preborn baby.
That ultrasound changed everything for me. It really did. That made it all worthwhile to know that I was going to have a little blessing. And when she got here, it was just, oh my gosh.
Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Meffer today? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies' lives. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your donation goes toward saving babies' lives. Call now, 855-402-2229, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Meffer today. I just have to say flat out that this transgender nonsense is completely out of control. I have several examples of this, and I'm going to try to squeeze them into this particular segment. Senator Elizabeth Warren, first of all, now says transgender border crossers and illegal aliens must be released into the United States. She and Senator Tammy Baldwin have sent a letter to DHS demanding that these transgender migrants and asylum seekers are particularly vulnerable to sexual harassment, discrimination, and abuse. Give me a break. How many transgender migrants are standing at the border trying to get? These people are ridiculous. And you know what? In some ways, it doesn't even warrant an actual refutation so much as it just deserves to have the paper that the story is printed on crumbled into a ball and tossed hard across the room. So that's what I'm going to do. Now, this story, though, is very, very bad, very upsetting. This is via LifeSite News. Out of Texas, a jury has ruled against a father who is trying to protect his 7-year-old little boy, James, from chemical castration because his mother wants to put him through a gender transition. They've got a picture here at LifeSite of Jeffrey Younger and his son, James, who is the cutest little boy. And I've read before, and the father maintains, this little boy does not think he's a girl and he doesn't want to be a girl. That's what the father has maintained. He has said that when the little boy comes to his house, he plays ball and acts like a normal boy. And then when he goes back to, I guess, his ex-wife's house, it's a different story. Now, listen to this. James's mother will be able to continue transitioning this little boy into Luna. I guess this is the new female name that this little boy is going to have. And the mother now has full authority to start him on puberty blockers and eventually cross-sex hormones. If this is not child abuse, I don't know what is. The jury's decision likely means that Mr. Younger will be required to affirm James as a girl despite his religious and moral objections and will also be forced to take a class on transgenderism. I'm sorry, did we somehow end up in a gulag country, a communist country, a totalitarian dictatorship? This is the United States of America. What has happened to us? And it was 11 out of the 12 jurors who decided this. It was over the issue of whether or not this father should be the sole managing conservator over his two twin boys, I guess, in this divorce. They voted that the current joint managing conservatorship should be replaced by a sole managing conservatorship, but that this father should not be that person. Yeah, because why would you want a loving father who's trying to preserve his little boy's manhood to be in charge of him over and against his mother who wants to turn him into a girl? Who are these 11 jurors? I have no idea who these 11 jurors are, but this just makes me fighting mad. They were in this whole court fight last week dealing with custody. And, you know, it's apparently an extremely acrimonious divorce. And you can understand why that would be. But this little boy is the ping pong ball in all of this. It's absolutely incredible. The mother, I guess, was asking the possession schedule of the father to be altered to decrease overnight stays and to force his visits with the boys to be supervised. She brought the original suit to the court, did not request a jury trial. The father did that, probably is regretting it now. But the jury ruled on his specific request for sole managing conservatorship, and the judge ruled on all other aspects of the petition as brought by the mom. She was also asking that her husband be, or ex-husband, be forbidden from calling his son James, which is his given name, and that he be prohibited from bringing James around people who do not affirm James as a girl. This is not anything less than flat out cult activity. Is this not cult activity? You will go along with the doctrine. You will be forced to comply. You will be controlled in what you can say. Is there sleep deprivation involved? Maybe lack of food that is given at I mean, really, it's like a cult. And, you know, my friend Stephen Black calls it that, the LGBTQ cult. He says, this is, you know, this is a religion, and more people are talking like this. This is a religion. And if you don't go along with the LGBTQ religion, you are committing heresy and you must be punished. Except you never get the beauty of being excommunicated. You just get, you know, put in the stocks, as it were. This poor father. I guess there were a number of protesters in Texas who are pushing for lawmakers to pass a law banning any sort of gender transitions for anybody under the age of 18. And I would say this should be across the board in all 50 states in the United States of America. It should be illegal for anybody under the age of 18 to undergo any sort of puberty blockers, chemical castration, or the like. This is so ghoulish. It's like Dr. Frankenstein's monster. And what's going to happen to these little kids when they grow up, especially if it turns out to be the case that the father is accurate and this little boy doesn't even want to be a girl? That's a totally new level of evil. If it is simply the mother wanting him to be a girl, good grief. Talk about Munchausen's by proxy. I have no idea if that's applicable in this case, but it's horrible. According to the Mayo Clinic, as they point out in this story, possible side effects of feminizing cross-sex hormone therapy are a blood clot in a deep vein, so deep vein thrombosis, or in a lung, pulmonary embolism, high triglycerides, a type of fat in your blood, gallstones, weight gain, elevated liver function tests, decreased libido, infertility, high potassium, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and excessive prolactin in the blood, or a condition in which a non-cancerous tumor or of the pituitary gland in the brain overproduces the hormone prolactin. So those are all the possible side effects from doing this sort of thing to a child. You know, all these children, I'm seeing this because we already know the statistics on children who have confusion over whether or not they're a boy or a girl, and some 90, 95% of them grow out of it. How many lawsuits are going to be filed against this transgender cult? I'm just wondering, how many therapists, how many medical doctors, how many parents, how many judges, who knows who is all going to be in the crosshairs when these kids grow up and say, you abused me. It's coming, folks. It's absolutely going to come. 10, 20, 30 years from now, these kids who come to at some point and say, this is insane. I mean, I was telling you just recently about what's going on in the UK, where you have hundreds of people coming forward who've gone through these gender transitions, so-called, and they regret it, and they're now detransitioning. It didn't solve my problem, and I really am a girl. I really am a boy. We're out of our minds. We really are out of our minds. If it weren't for the fact that you have medical advancements, although I would say it's medical regression if you're actually trying to change somebody's given sex, it has created the problem. I mean, this is we're really thankful for all of the medical advancements that benefit us, where we have open heart surgery and heart transplants and all those sorts of things, which are wonderful. But the downside is when you can do pretty much anything you want in a surgical facility, you can do some really evil stuff. And that's what we're talking about here with gender transitions. Now, I don't know if there's any sort of surgery involved here. It sounds like it's just chemical, but how evil can you get? Seriously, how evil can you get? Oh, and then you have on the transgender front, this cycling champion. Did you hear about this Rachel McKinnon? It's actually a man, Reese McKinnon, who's changed his name to Rachel. And you look at this picture here of this transgender cyclist dominating women's cycling, won the Masters Track Cycling World Championships in Manchester, England, set a world record. Yeah, it's really easy to do that when you're a man competing against women. And the picture of this man who thinks he's a woman standing up holding the flag looks as masculine as you can possibly look, except for the bad hairdo. You know, and now and has said in the past that anybody who is against this issue of men competing in women's sports is denying them their human rights. Give me a break. You know, every time we hear this nonsense, we have to just full out reject it, mock it, and tell people this is ridiculous. Honestly, because if we don't start doing that in large numbers, it's only going to get worse. It's only going to continue. It's only going to spread and metastasize. And that's the last thing we need. Oh, by the way, I go back to a story here at the College Fix in September. The same cyclist who's a transgender philosophy professor was the one who put out on Twitter when David Koch died just recently. This is the same person who wrote, it's okay to be happy, even celebrate when bad people die. Isn't that touching? So, you know, we're all haters and transphobes if we think that men should not compete in women's sports. But he can get out there and say, it's okay to be happy, even celebrate when bad people die. And then a Twitter user asked this person if that sentiment would apply to online feminist influencer Magdalene Burns, who at the time was suffering from terminal brain cancer and then died but objected to the trans thing. And the College of Charleston academic Rachel Reese McKinnon has had a beef with Burns and referred to her as a transphobe. And he said, if they're a trash human actively trying to harm marginalized people because of who they are, I think it's justified. I mean, this is someone who's really, really disturbed. Women in sports need to stand up for themselves and say, enough is enough is enough is enough, or women's sports will go away. And I'll tell you what, we're going to lose a lot more than female sports if we don't stand up to the transgender agenda right now. Please pray for that father, by the way, and for that little boy, especially little James. Unbelievable what's going on. Pray for our country. Hey, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time right here on Janet Mefford Today.